and the environment. And now your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. I like to spend time doing research in areas that have not generally been covered by the mainstream media, or have been covered but done so with a bias, always towards the orthodox or official position, as if, with all the resources a major network has, they are not capable of starting from the point that what if that official agency were simply wrong? What if it were not in their best interest to tell the truth? What if in their zeal that they not only didn't tell the truth, but what if they out and out lied to people about things? Well, that's what we try to do. I try to bring you the other side of the story. And on our program today, we're going to look at the other side of the story, and we're going to look at it from several different points of view, not the least of which is going to examine such areas as the human cost of animal experiments, something we just never hear about. In fact, if you ever hear anything about animal experiments, it's always something that's perceived of as positive, something that was necessary, and we just want to offer different opinions. I'm going to do two statements on animal experiments, and then I'm going to look at such things as lymphatic plague, what's going on with the lymphatic systems, also the epidemic of unnecessary mastectomies, and how not to become a victim. And then I'm going to talk about the world's farmland degraded. What's happening with our farmland all over the world? And why do we continue to have less and less quality soil made available for farmers and for farming? It does impact upon us. I'm also going to look at how the tobacco industry had documents that exposed how R.J. Reynolds' marketing plan targeted San Francisco gays and homeless people. His project was called SCUM, S-C-U-M. You haven't heard about it. It hasn't been broadcast once in any of the major media. And finally, I want to talk about obesity in children is now at record levels. How do we get this way? And then I want to set aside, time permitting, part of today's program to take calls. And I'll be taking calls, probably in a half hour or so. Let's begin by examining the work of Katrina Fox in Nexus, an article entitled The Human Cost of Animal Experiments. And by the way, there is strong scientific evidence that animal-based testing is grossly inaccurate in evaluating how a drug or product will affect humans, and is a grave risk to the health and safety of people and animals alike. But mind you, I was working with animals, but never was an animal sacrificed, never was it hurt, never was it tortured. I simply did evaluations of their nutrition and saw that when I improved their nutrition, I could improve their lifespan. This then led to the basis of much of the dietary recommendation I'm able to offer today. And indeed, it certainly has made a difference. But you can't imagine how other scientists deem these animals. They deem them as, well, merely as expendable. And many of the studies I'm going to be citing are absolutely barbaric. And you just can't imagine that taxpayer money or private industry is doing research where there is no way in the world they can extrapolate what's happening to that animal as being relevant to humans, in that they do it anyhow. Let's take a look at the scientific evidence against vivisection. Now, graphic pictures of cats with electrodes clamped to their heads, or monkeys strapped to chairs with their brains cut open and their eyes filled with pain and terror, are enough to upset momentarily even the most hardened person. But most of us put these images out of our mind and accept the situation because we're told by the government and medical establishment that such experiments are for our own good. They insist that without these procedures, there'll never be cures for the world's diseases, and that those who oppose animal experiments are extremists holding back progress. Yet despite the supposed strident astringency and animal test on drugs deemed safe for human consumption and released onto the market, 2 million Americans became seriously ill and approximately 100,000 died every year because of reactions to medicines that were properly prescribed. That doesn't include the figures, by the way, of how many people die from improperly prescribed medications. That's just what we know. Now, mind you, the former commissioner of the FDA, Kessler, stated that drug adverse reports were grossly underestimated. In fact, it's been suggested that only 2% of adverse drug reactions are actually recorded, because most people don't know that a reaction they're having is from a drug. They may attribute it to something else, as well as may their doctor. And we often don't know why people die. If they have cancer, we assume it's because of the cancer. We don't say it could be due to the chemotherapy shutting down the liver, shutting down the kidneys, causing a lowered immune system, so a person gets pneumonia and then dies of pneumonia. They'll say death due to cancer with complications from pneumonia. Well, what if the person hadn't received the radiation therapy? One of my buddies died not because he had a brain tumor. The brain tumor was successfully removed at a VA hospital. It was the 60 treatments of radiation that was considered preventative. I remember talking with him and saying, "Hey, Jerry, let me give you a preventative program, one that is much better than anything they're going to give you. They're just going to give you radiation." And radiation does the following. I list through a whole criteria, and of all the things that were negative. He thought about it, and then I went on tour. And I was on tour for about 2 months. And then one day he shows up at my ranch down in Texas. And it was like seeing a ghost. He had emaciated down. And when he came on the property, and this was one of the sad days of my life, I'm working out in the field with some buffalo. And I see this car pull up. It was a cab. And I see this frail old person get out of the cab. So I walk over the fence, and for a second, it didn't hit me that this was my buddy. And we sit down, and he said that he'd come down there because he had no place else to go to die. And he didn't want to die in a hospital. He didn't want to die alone in his apartment. And he just wanted to be around someone that was familiar to him. And he was suffering from radiation-induced sickness from the therapy. And not once did any of his doctors look at his condition. Not once did any of the VA radiologists or oncologists say, "Hey, we're giving this guy too much." Like most doctors, and like virtually all of these facilities, they have protocols. And honoring the protocol becomes more important than honoring the patient. It's as if there's a chip that's inserted in their brains that tells them, "We can't make independent choices. We have to go by the cookbook." And if the cookbook says the ingredient is 60 treatments of radiation, even if the patient's dying from the radiation, we have to keep giving it to him. And it's hard to believe this happens in this society, but it happens more often than it does not happen, that the protocols are used right ahead. So anyhow, here's my buddy, and we're sitting there talking, and I tried preparing some different ways of food, and he couldn't hold anything in. That's why he was emaciated. He was cachexic. Normally, he was about 165 pounds. He was 105 pounds. He looked like a concentration camp survivor. Very gaunt. His skin was just hanging off of him. And so I suggested that I could fly him back to New York, and we could get him into a program at the Institute. In every likelihood, we could reverse this. But he was too weak to even want to try. He had made up his mind he was going to die. And to all the arguments to the contrary, he was very stubborn, and I'd known him for 20 years, and I knew that if that's what he was going to do, he was going to do it. And you can't really help people unless they want your help. Even when they want your help, you can't still change the course of all things if something's too far gone. But at least I want to try. I don't believe in giving up on anyone. And it was very, very sad for me to see this happening. And there was just such a disappointment that once again, medicine had been so utterly predictable in what it did. And he eventually went into the local hospital, and he died there. I was able to get some nutrition into him by putting it into an aloe base and using certain herbs that at least quieted the stomach to allow it to be absorbent. Too little, too late. And I'm just thinking, and he was telling me that, well, at the hospital, they just kept giving him more drugs and more drugs and more drugs. And then they just sent him home. Said there was nothing more they could do. So I said, so here, they cut out his brain tumor, successful operation, good, and then they kill him. Now, his death would have been recorded as complications from cancer. It would not have been called iatrogenic death. It wouldn't have been labeled. And I just give this as a point because we probably have 98% of all the people who are having adverse effects, it's never recorded. If it were, then it would show that so much of what we're given in the name of good science is bad science and terrible medicine. But we don't. So that's why people can continue to do the things they do. And remember this figure, the figure of accepting 100,000 deaths by properly prescribed medications exceeds the number of deaths for all illegal drugs combined at an annual cost of over $135 billion in healthcare expenses. In England, an estimated 70,000 preventable deaths and severe disability occur each year because of adverse reactions to prescription drugs, making this the third most common cause of death after heart attack and stroke. And the drug company Sibagaigi has estimated that only 5% of chemicals found safe and effective in animal tests actually reach the market as prescription drugs. Even so, during 1976 to 85, the Food and Drug Administration approved 209 new compounds. But of those 209 compounds, 102 of which were either withdrawn or relabeled because of severe, unpredictable side effects, including heart attacks, kidney failure, liver failure, and stroke. Now, mind you, on the one hand, we're told, well, this is an FDA-approved drug. Hence, we're supposed to be given an assurance that these are safe. No, 52% of all the things the FDA approved were not safe. A stroke, a liver failure, a kidney failure, and a heart attack is not safe. That could have been worse than the condition for which the drug had been used to begin with. The animal rights movement has lobbied for years against animal experimentation on more on ethical grounds, but the scientific evidence against vivisection is far stronger. Researchers who put their careers on the line and publicly admit that animal-based models are inaccurate for evaluating the effects of drugs in humans are encouraged or forced to be silent. Why? It's a multi-billion dollar industry. Two such researchers are Dr. Ray Greek, an American anesthesiologist, and his wife, Jean Swindle-Greek, a veterinarian dermatologist. Both are ex-vivisectors who have studied medical and scientific literature, which is largely unavailable and inscrutable to the public. And using the industry's own data, they exposed in their new book, Sacred Cows and Golden Geese, The Human Cost of Animal Experimentation, how we are kept in the dark about the dangers to our health from animal experiments. Now, why animal models are not predictive is never discussed. Open up a rat, or a dog, or a pig, and a human, and you'll find much the same terrain, but with differences. But it is precisely these differences which have an impact when it comes to assimilating drugs. For example, rats, the species most commonly used in vivisection, have no gallbladder and excrete bile very effectively. Many drugs are excreted via bile, so this affects the half-life of the drug. drugs bind to rat plasma much less efficiently. Rats always breathe through the nose. Because some chemicals are absorbed in the nose, some are filtered. So rats get a different mix of substances entering their system. Also, they are nocturnal. Their gut flora are in a different location. Their skin has different absorption properties than that of humans. Any one of these discrepancies will alter drug metabolism. Now, these differences are only on a gross level. Medications act on a microscopic level, initiating or interrupting chemical reactions that are far too small for the human eye to observe. And we differ on a cellular level and molecular level, and importantly, that is where disease occurs. The cells of chimpanzees are very similar to the cells of humans, but the spatial organization of the cells is vastly different. Even those who favor the animal model admit its unpredictability among peers. Dr. Ralph Haywood, director of the Huntington Research Center in the United States, says, quote, "The best guess for the correct correlation of adverse reactions in man and animal toxicity data is somewhere between 5% and 25%, unquote. Dr. Herbert Hensel, director of the Institute of Physiology at Marburg University, goes further. He says, quote, "In the opinion of leading biostatisticians, it is not possible to transfer the probability predictions from animals to humans," unquote. "At present, therefore, there exists no possibility at all of a scientifically based prediction. In this respect, the situation is even less favorable than a game of chance," unquote. Well, what's that tell you? Even the most widely respected textbook on animal experimentation states, quote, "Uncritical reliance on the results of animal tests can be dangerously misleading and cost the health and lives of tens of thousands of humans," unquote. The best known example of this is thalidomide. Mothers who took this drug to ameliorate morning sickness gave birth to children with shocking deformities, and most lacking developed limbs. Animal tests had not predicted this. The first recorded case of side effects occurred on Christmas Day, 1956, but in 1957, this drug was released anyway. Let's just take a look at what the Greens put in their book. These are just some examples of the pharmaceutical drugs which have been deemed safe for human use after extensive animal testing, but which were later found to cause serious side effects. If nothing else, this should give you pause before you would accept when the FDA or your physician or someone says, "But it's been tested in animals and proven safe." Well, let's take a look at birth control pills. These are known to cause life-threatening blood clots in some women, yet scientists have still not been able to reproduce this finding in animals. In fact, dog testing predicted that the pill would decrease the likelihood of clotting. Just the opposite were true. Amarinone, the use of this drug for treating heart failure, led to 20% of patients developing thrombocytopenia, or lack of blood cells needed for clotting, despite a comprehensive program of animal studies in mice, rats, hamsters, guinea pigs, dogs, and rhesus monkeys. Many of these patients died. Then you have a chloramphenicol. This antibiotic caused life-threatening anemia in humans, and it's an example of a drug whose effects vary from species to species. Dogs did well with it. Cats died from it. Cows tolerate it, but horses do not. It is so toxic to susceptible humans that its use has been outlawed in animals used for food. The tiny amount consumed from ingesting a hamburger made from a treated cow will cause death in such a person unless they receive a bone marrow transplant. Then you have Cliquenol, this anti-diarrheal passed test in rats, cats, dogs, and rabbits. It was pulled off the shelves all over the world in 1982 after it was found to cause blindness and paralysis in humans. Diethylstilbestrol, this synthetic estrogen, was designed to prevent miscarriage, but it did just the opposite by increasing the rate of spontaneous abortions and premature births and neonatal deaths. No human trials were done. All the safety data were collected from animals. Then you have Araldin. This heart drug was withdrawn after causing serious side effects in 7,000 victims, 23 of whom died. It had been tested for 6 years in mice, rats, dogs, and monkeys, and when introduced on the market was, quote, particularly notable for the thoroughness with which its toxicity was studied in animals, to the satisfaction of the authorities, unquote. Ah. Even long after the drug was withdrawn, scientists failed to reproduce these results in animals. So 7,000 humans became victims, 23 died, and yet nothing was shown in the animal tests. Floxin, this antibiotic, progressed through animal testing only to cause seizures and psychosis when used in humans, but it did not cause seizures and psychosis in animals. Isopyrrole, a medication used to treat asthma, it proved devastatingly toxic to humans in the amounts recommended based on animal studies. In Great Britain alone, just in Great Britain, 3,500 asthmatics died from using this single medication. Imagine 3,500 deaths from a single medication use. But it happened. Then you've got Manoplax, this heart drug, which has been tested on rats and mice and rabbits and cats and guinea pigs, was withdrawn worldwide in 1993 after analysis of patients showed that those taking were at increased risk of hospitalization and death. Then you have methotrexate. This treatment for migraines led to severe scarring of the heart and kidneys and blood vessels in the abdomen, although scientists have been unable to reproduce any of those effects that happen in humans in animals. And then you have Oprin. This treatment for rheumatism and arthritis killed 61 people, caused 3,500 adverse reactions. The drug had been used on monkeys and for 9 years with no adverse side effects. Then you had PPA, which is a phenylpropylamine. This drug, found in many cold and flu remedies, was banned by the FDA in the U.S. after it was linked to causing between 200 and 500 strokes in young women in a single year. Premacor, this medicine given when the heart is not pumping enough blood, worked well in rats, but increased the incidence of death in humans by 30%. And then Ritodrine, this drug prescribed to avert premature labor, induced pulmonary edema, which is fluid in the lungs causing breathing difficulties and possible death. And Suprefin, this arthritis drug, was withdrawn from the market when patients suffered kidney toxicity. And prior to its release, researchers said this about the animal test, quote, excellent safety profile. No cardiac or renal, kidney, or central nervous system side effects in any species, unquote. Well, so much for the animal test. It was toxic. It hurt people. And then, of course, we have tamoxifen, which is commonly used today. This drug, used to treat and prevent breast cancer women, caused liver tumors in rats, but not in mice or hamsters. The drug had been shown to be harmless to the developing fetus of rabbits and monkeys, but to cause bone abnormalities in rat fetuses. And one of the side effects is nausea and vomiting. But this was not predicted in animal studies. Even though high doses were tested in dogs, the species considered most predictive of vomiting in humans. The drug has also been implicated in uterine cancer, blood clots, memory loss, absence of periods, and eye damage such as cataracts. And then you have Zomax. This arthritic drug killed 14 people and caused many more to suffer. So these are all just some examples of popular drugs used by almost all physicians that did not show any of the harmful effects that occurred in humans when they were tested on animals. So we should pay attention to this. One of the reasons why so many drugs cause adverse reactions in humans, reactions which were not predicted in animals, is because of the inaccuracy of toxicity tests carried out. The notorious test, probably the most notorious of these, is the LD50, Dray's test. LD stands for lethal dose 50%, where animals, usually dogs and rats, are force-fed, forced to inhale, or are injected with a chemical until 50% of them die. That dosage is then designated as the LD50. It's unrealistic and unreliable, and it's obvious when we consider the huge variables such as the age, weight, and gender of the animals, not to mention the environmental conditions under which the test took place. And these variables render the results invalid even for the species tested, let alone for humans. And yet that didn't seem to matter. And the regulatory guidelines for the safety assessment of chemicals worldwide is what we've been going on, and they're just not working. In the United States, although the FDA no longer requires the test and will accept in vitro and other non-animal-based alternatives, it still accepts the LD50, so the testing continues. And in November 2000, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which comprises 29 member countries, agreed to abolish the LD50 test and phase it out this year. But the alternatives, which will take its place, are merely a refinement of the original. They still involve the use of animals, and therefore are still wholly unreliable indicators of human health. In the United States, the Voluntary Children's Health Chemical Testing Program is being developed by the EPA, and it involves extensive animal testing to determine the safe amount of toxic poisons to which children can be exposed, as well as animal tests allowing unsafe drugs onto the market. The flip side is that human health is also compromised when drugs which may be beneficial to humans are prevented from being released. Most drugs have side effects, some of which are more acute than others, but many useful medications used to save lives would not have reached clinical trials if they had first been tested on animals. We only have to look at our own medicine cabinets, for example. Today, about 29 billion aspirins per year are sold in the United States, and twice that number worldwide. Yet aspirin causes birth defects in mice and rats and results in extensive blood abnormalities in cats that they can only take 20% of the human dose every third day. Another painkiller, ibuprofen, causes kidney failure in dogs, even at low doses. Other prescription drugs were initially unavailable to people because of animal studies' predicted side effects not found in humans. They include the corticosteroids. They have been shown to cause cancer in some rodents, despite their being used by humans. Depo-provera. This contraceptive was barred from release in the U.S. in 1973 because it caused cancer in dogs and baboons. FK-506 is an anti-rejection drug, was almost shelved before it proceeded to clinical trials. After experimenting on dogs, researchers said animal toxicity was too severe to proceed to the clinical stage. And penicillin. The release of penicillin was delayed when its discoverer, Alexander Fleming, put it on one side because it did not work in rabbits. And this is because rabbits excrete penicillin in their urine. Only when Fleming had a sick human patient and nothing else to try did he administer penicillin with excellent results. And then you have Prilosec. The release of this gastrointestinal medication was delayed for 12 years because the effect on animals, which did not occur in humans. And streptozomycin. This popular antibiotic caused birth defects, such as limb malformations in offspring of rats. Now, mind you, I personally do not support the use of corticosteroids. I certainly am opposed to Depo-Provera. I would not recommend FK-506. I believe that penicillin does have a place and has saved lives. There's no question about that. And was one of the miracle discoveries in medicine. But has so been overused so often by so many individuals that it is doing more harm than good, and is setting people up for super infections that cannot be helped by any type of antibiotic. And the same with streptozomycin. When a person has a bacterial infection that is susceptible to that antibiotic, it could help them or save their life. But look at the reality. The reality is that today, with over 100 million prescriptions for penicillin, a full 30% were for colds or flu, which are viral. And antibiotics have no impact upon viruses, only bacteria, and then only on certain strains of bacteria. So what happens when you take an antibiotic and you don't need it? It adversely affects, in every single case, your immune system. It will cause a redistribution of negative bacteria in your gastrointestinal system. It will allow candida to flourish, and it can cause thrush. It can cause a weakening of the phagocytic activity in the bloodstream. Now, during the late 70s and through almost all the 80s, there was an enormous surge in drug use, recreational drug use. And that's when the sexual revolution was really hitting high momentum. From 75 to 85, that 10-year period, the disco scene was very, very strong. And if you lived here in New York City where I'm at, and you went to Studio 54, which I did, I loved the music, I loved the environment. You had every kind of odd and strange and sexy and unusual persons there. It was just a very, very exciting place if you liked to dance and if you liked the music, both of which I did. But you also saw, if you went into any of their bathrooms there, and they were kind of unisexual bathrooms, you saw everyone doing drugs. Or if you went up to the VIP lounge, which I did, drugs. And every kind of drug imaginable. But you also saw a lot of sex, all of it unprotected. And that's when I was also doing some research pre-AIDS, pre-1984, the official definition. I was doing some research. In fact, I'd been working for 5 years on a special report on, were we challenging the old morality? And so I went across the United States, and I was asking people, older, younger, metropolitan, rural, professionals, lay people, all walks of life, all strata, going on university campuses, interviewing people, what they thought of the sexual revolution. Were they participating in it? If so, how? What was their experience? What did they learn from it? And I found, to my surprise, that very, very few people actually were liberated sexually. Most were still maintaining a more conservative approach when it came to sex. Most people were still monogamous. Most people were not experimenting, but everybody was watching people who were. And the media focused upon the exaggeration and exhibitionism, which is true almost of everything. You know, if you've got 25 people in a room all dressed the same, talking the same, looking the same, and one person dresses a clown, everybody pays attention to the clown. And one of the ways that we get attention in our society is just to be different. Well, the one place you could be different is in your sexuality. And one of the ways a lot of people did their sex was they assumed that their openness sexually also meant that they would be using drugs. So you had the sex-drugs combination. Now, not everyone who was experimenting sexually was using drugs. A lot of couples that I interviewed in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, Miami, they didn't. For all intents and purposes, no one knew that they were participating in a sexual liberation of their own because they did their regular job and had their families or whatever, and no, it was just their own quiet, private thing. But the ones who were partying, they were partying hard. And I remember a buddy of mine, when I told him what I was doing, he said, "Oh, I'm scared. This is great, great research. I got to, you know, let me come along. I just want to hear all this. I think it'd be kind of interesting." I said, "Fine." I said, "But yeah, I got to understand, this isn't a 9-to-5 thing. It only starts at night." He said, "Well, I can handle that." Now, my buddy is very healthy. At that time, he was about 28. He was an athlete. Didn't drink. Didn't smoke. He was a lacto-ovo-vegetarian at that time. Took all of his vitamins. And if you looked at him, you'd say, "Hey, dude, you're healthy." Well, I remember we started off on a Friday evening. And I went to the various clubs and brought him with me. And we went to the Studio 54 and we went to Infinity and New York and Bonds. And I knew one of the club owners and who owned three of those clubs. And we'd always have access and be able to talk with people. And there'd always be a sprinkling of celebrities who made the same circuit almost every night. And it was kind of funny. I'd be sitting there, and this is just as an interesting aside, and people who I will not mention would come over and say, "Hi, Gary. Gary, what do you think he should be taking, for B-complex? Should he take them individually, or should he take them as a 10-milligram tablet?" And now, listen to Gary. He's the most famous nutritionist in the world. You got to listen to him, all right? Okay. And here's a guy. And this really sticks out in my mind. Here's a guy sitting there drinking scotch in one hand. He's got Coke all over his nose. He's got a cup of Coke. And these VIP rooms that have bowls of this stuff. And he's sitting there zonked, asking me about the B-complex. Like, okay, well, if I do my B1, 5 milligrams, I'm healthy. No, you're smoking, you're drinking, you're doing coke, and you're going to be dead in 5 years. And sure enough, he was. He was a very famous designer. And I just remember it. But the actress who was his friend, who no matter what I would suggest to her, would never do it. But it was interesting how many celebrities, this is the fun part of this, how many celebrities come over to you that would never, if you were not known to them, would never give you the time of day, walk right by you on the street. But every party I ever went to, I mean, if there was someone there, they always wanted to ask questions. But they always did it in the funniest way. In fact, I remember a friend of mine asked me, said, "Gary, why don't you come out? You're working too hard. Give yourself a break." This is 3 years ago. And I just finished a long PBS tour. I'd done like 40 cities in 38 days. Doing two cities sometimes a day. Just, it was like a political tour. I jumped from a plane to a plane. 8 days in a row, I never even got to a hotel I'd have to be washing up in the bathrooms of these television studios. And I'd never been on a tour like that before. And it was quite an experience. And it was very beneficial, and it helped everybody. And so I was pleased about getting the message out. After all, if you're crying in the wilderness for most of your career for people to at least pay attention to things they can do to improve their life, and you're suddenly given, okay, it's your turn. Now you got the big audience. You take advantage of it, because that's what it's about, getting a message to as many people as possible, who then can either choose to use it or not use it. And there's a cost to that. And you see, it's just, it's like running a marathon. I'll love it when I cross the finish line, but I won't necessarily like how I feel on the 20-mile mark. So there I was back from the tour one day. My friend, who's part of a couple, called and said, "Come on out, join us in the Hamptons for a day." So I go out. I take a train out. And they pick me up station and go to their home. And had a humongous backyard with big, giant shrubs, like 20-foot-high shrubs. It looked like one of those English maize gardens in the back. And on the way, we went by this Amagansett Market, and I said, "Well, let me stop, and we'll get some stuff, and I'll make us lunch." And they were happy about that, because the two of them together, I don't think, have ever done more than pour water. And everything is ordered in. They don't have anything in the fridge. So knowing that, I went, they had a ball shopping for everything, and they didn't know what anything was. I had to explain to them bib letters. They just knew it was green. And so we got back out there, and the next thing you know, she comes and she's, "Oh, by the way, Gary, you don't mind if I invite another, friend?" It's, "No, all right." Next thing you know, she keeps sticking her head in the kitchen saying, "Oh, by the way, such and such is coming too." And what she had done is she'd gotten on the phone and told all of her friends, all of whom were famous people, "Gary Knoll's here." And so everybody wanted consultation. I didn't know this. So next thing you know, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I've been in the kitchen since 9 o'clock. I'm working for 4 hours nonstop. I prepared a buffet for 28 people. Every single one of those 28 people would be familiar with anyone in this audience. And some, quite frankly, were phenomenally gifted people. I mean, there's one violinist who is one of the handful of the best violinists in the world. And there were people from all different areas, but they were well known. So I finally finish. I put the buffet out. And then I'm tired, so I go out and I sit on a swing out in the yard and just relax and just enjoying watching some butterflies and a wonderful smell of fresh-cut grass. And then they start. One at a time, they come over and wanting to know about this, that, and the other condition. And then after one finished, I look, and now there's like a congregation that moved from the dining area, which they really loved the lunch, right? And, oh, do you do private cooking? Yeah, right. I'm going to come and cook for you. Not in this lifetime. And they was like all milling around. And what I thought, I just took a moment, because this has happened my whole career, especially with my buddies in Hollywood and one of my friends who's a top producer. Guys would come to his house same way. You know, they when they find out they can get, you know, some health invite and information, and they're sitting there smoking cigarettes, asking me about their emphysema. That was a kick. Guy smoking a cigarette saying, Gary, which vitamin would help this emphysema? And I said, well, how about stop smoking? No, I can't do that. You know, it helps me. I get, what vitamin? And then a guy brings meat to the lunch. This was something I forgot. And this guy is really toxic. Nice guy, but he's toxic. And he says, so my friend comes in and says, Gary, would you mind cooking this? I said, yes, I would mind. That's an offense to me. I won't cook meat for someone. You know, if they want to cook the meat, you cook it. And what was of interest is my friend tried cooking the meat and didn't work. So he actually was forced to eat healthy food. Now, that was a punishment to a celebrity. They generally find that offensive. And they actually go to confession. They ate healthy food, forgive them, and they'll have three Hail Marys. Well, he actually enjoyed it. And then he wanted to get into debate versus meat versus, you know, the vegetarian versus the meat eater. And I'm looking at this pathetic lump of a human being in a wheelchair telling me that meat makes you strong. And I'm thinking, well, what are you doing in a wheelchair sick? Not hereditary, not congenital, you know, just total toxicity. I didn't say it to him. I just humored him because there was no point in ruining a beautiful day. And so finally, 2.5 hours later, I managed to say I was going to the restroom, went in the house, out the door, and walked the 2.5 miles to the train station and took a train back. The next day, my friend locates me and says, gee, Gary, where'd you go? There were so many people I had questions for you. I said, I'm sure there were. And not one of those people would ever take a single scintilla advice to change anything that was important in their health. Celebrities can be the most spoiled and petulant and immature of people you've ever met. There are exceptions. I haven't met anybody. I'm being optimistic. God. And I've counseled so many, you have no idea. I mean, and I've never betrayed a name, and I won't under any conditions. But it's tough, because they don't live in the same world we do. They have too many yes people, and too many people are willing to let unbridled egos and this sense of significance over others. And yet, just being people, they still have to function. They're still going to get sick. And unfortunately, they're not open always to doing what's in their best interest. So when I'm going around the disco scene, I'm sitting there with people who are doing coke, doing lots of alcohol. Now, you mix coke and alcohol, and you're going to end up with a totally destroyed immune system. But then something else I started to see, antibiotics. Everybody was popping antibiotics in massive amounts. I'm not talking about one antibiotic. I saw one very beautiful, at that time, model, actress. And she said, Gary, she said, maybe you could help me. I've got a friend that's got this particular condition, and he's going to be tested for a screen test. And he can't get bonded if it's shown that he has a sexually transmitted disease. And he's afraid that if he goes into a regular doctor's office, it'll get out to the National Enquirer. And so do you have anything that you could suggest? And she said, but you know what I've been suggesting? And it's really working. I'm suggesting antibiotics, and because you can get antibiotics for things other than sexually transmitted disease. And she opened up her purse, and the thing was half filled with antibiotics. And I said, and what are you doing with those? She said, I don't want to get a sexually transmitted disease. I'm taking it to prevent it. I said, and where did you learn that bit of wisdom? She said, all the clubs. I said, all the clubs, like there's some genius at the door of a club that says, I anoint you with wisdom. Take a handful of antibiotics and prevent sexually transmitted disease. I said, you cannot prevent a sexually transmitted disease by taking an antibiotic. They don't work prophylactically. It's not possible. All you're doing is destroying your immune system. Have you noticed that you've had candida? Have you had yeast infections? She said, yeah. I said, have you had urinary problems? Yeah. Have you had fatigue? Yeah. And I went through all the conditions that are going to occur. And she said, I just thought that was from partying a lot. Well, that's nonsense that goes on and went on. And everywhere I went in the club scene, those people who were using drugs and doing lots of the sex were taking massive amounts of antibiotics. They won't knock you out the first day or even the 10th day. But these people had made this a way of life. We finished up at 7 o'clock in the morning. And my friend was just wiped. The next day, I call and say, it's 7 o'clock, we're ready to go again in the evening. He dragged him, so this time he didn't have all that pep and enthusiasm. This time we went to the gay clubs, the fast track clubs. And there he saw stuff he just never saw in his life. And because he's heterosexual. And I said, look at a subset of the gay population, the fast tracks. And he saw multiple sexual partners. It was all done in the open. There was no hiding any of this stuff. Drugs and antibiotics, smoking and drinking. And when I was interviewing some of the people, they say, they've been doing this for 2 years, every night, 7 nights a week, and still working and functioning in the daytime, smoking, drinking, antibiotics, junk food, and partying all night. And then I started asking, have you had hepatitis? Yeah. How many times have you been infected? Well, 5 times. Syphilis? Yeah. Gonorrhea? They had it all. Kept partying and spreading. Well, at the end of the third night, my friend was so wiped that he couldn't wake up the next day, and he slept for 12 straight hours. I said, now, here you're a healthy person. You did no drugs. You did no alcohol. Didn't have sex. You just came to observe. And you're wiped at 3 days. What do you think's happening to them at the end of a year or 2 years? I said, I predict. Now, mind you, this was 1977. I said, I predict within 3 to 4 years, most of these people will be dead. They will have exhausted their immune system, and they could get a cold and die. They'll have renal failure. And there were a lot of them had gay men's bowel disease, massive diarrhea, malnutrition. And sure enough, that's what preceded AIDS for 5 years. 7 years preceded it. But it was interesting to see just the indiscriminate use of antibiotics and what it did. So when I say that antibiotics, and also the kind of the interest that people, as long as they kept themselves thin or muscular, from the outside you looked at someone and you say, gee, you're muscular. You didn't know they were dying on the inside. And even the contradiction between people who want to believe they want to be healthy, and yet almost everything in their lifestyle creates disease. And people who could have afforded to have had the best in health care had the worst, and did so with such abandon. When I look back at the roster of all the people I met and all the people I tried to give advice to who are asking me for advice, not one of them taking it. How many of those people are dead and died in the 80s or early 90s? And you think that's all changed? Come with me for one night. And I've done a whole follow-up of what's changed from what we've learned about the use of drugs and on our immune system in a culture today in alcohol. And I'll take you to parties where there are 18-year-olds. I'll take you down south of Houston Street on a street at 4 o'clock in the morning where there'll be 5,000 people on the streets filled with little bars and little nightclubs. And every drug and every alcohol and cigarette, everything you could put in your body to hurt yourself, they've done it all night long, every night. So what's changed? Nothing. Just the names of the conditions will change. It won't be AIDS they'll be, you know, struggling from. And it won't happen all overnight. It'll take 2 to 3, even 4 years. That's how resilient the immune system is. But in time, they'll succeed. They'll beat it down and destroy it. So any lessons? Not on this generation. Because they all think they're impervious. And you can meet the same celebrities, and they'll still ask, they'll come over with coke up their nose, whiskey in their hand, cigarette on their lips, and say, Gary, how much vitamin C do I need to help my memory? And you kind of look at them, and you think, well, you have a good evening, too. Because it's not going to make any difference what's said. You have to look at the context in which things occur. Let's take a look at the war on cancer. According to Dr. Ray and Jean Greek, 40% of us will have a diagnosis of cancer at some time in our lives. It is the one disease which most of us will have had some encounter with, whether personally or through contact with friends or family. But despite billions of dollars poured into the cancer research, the medical establishment is not winning the war against cancer. Deaths from the disease are increasing. For example, in 1973 to 1992, they went up 6.3% in the United States. The Greeks reveal in their book that despite thousands of substances being fed to and painted on and injected into hundreds of millions of animals, we are no closer to saving lives. In many cases, animal experimentation has actually led to more life loss and introduced new drugs. There are more than 200 different forms of human cancer. Some of these have counterparts in animals, although even these differ greatly from those in humans in terms of cause, effect, treatment, and prognosis. A histiocytoma is fatal in humans but benign in dogs, as all cancers have species-specific effects. Ironically, in the 1950s, the only known carcinogens were those found by studying human epidemiological studies. A study of dye workers showed a high incidence of bladder cancer, and droves of dye lab animals failed to prove the rule. Chromium was found to be carcinogenic in humans, but not in animals, and the link between radiation and cancer was also reported from studies at that time. In 1956, British doctors warned of carcinogenic effects of x-rays given during pregnancy, resulting in childhood cancers. But no amount of irradiated pregnant quadrupeds necessarily produced the same effect. And in these instances, many others, the inability to validate carcinogenicity in animals kept cancer-causing agents legal for a much longer time. Asbestos is another example. The link between cancer and asbestos was made as long as 1907, but scientists failed to induce asbestos disease in animals. It took more than 30 years before the human model evidence became irrefutable. And between 1970 and 1985, researchers subjected an estimated 400 million animals to more than 500,000 compounds to check for anti-cancer effects. And based upon these animal experiments, only 80 compounds progressed to clinical trials. and just 24 proved to have anti-cancer activity in humans. And of these, 12 went on to have a substantial role in chemotherapy. But all 12 of these compounds were clinical variations of previously known chemotherapeutic agents. The fact that these chemicals could be used to fight cancer had already been predicted by their chemical structure. In other words, for 15 years, billions of dollars of invested money were plowed into subjecting millions of animals to the most painful, cruel, and barbaric procedures, and then killing them, all which proved nothing. Even the U.S. National Cancer Institute has admitted its failures. In the Los Angeles Times, May 6, 1998, the NCI director, Richard Klausner, was quoted as saying, quote, "The history of cancer research has been a history of curing cancer in the mouse. We have cured mice of cancer for decades, and it simply didn't work in humans," unquote. In the United States in the 1990s, scientists came up with the idea of genetically engineering rats to accept human cancers. But in 63% of the cases, according to the reports, the human tumors in the rats did not respond to chemotherapies, which are currently and effectively used in humans, because the way cancer grows in animals is different from how they grow in humans. It begs the question as to how many anti-cancer drugs, which could be successful in treating human cancers, have been missed because they did not work in rats or mice. And chemotherapeutic agents, which have been successful in humans, have all come from non-animal means. The next time any of us is tempted to put money into a tin shaken by cancer research charities which fund research using animal models, we would do well to remember the words of Dr. Erwin Bross, who I had on this program over 20 years ago, formerly the Roswell Park Memorial Institute for Cancer Research. In testimony before the U.S. Congress in 1981, he said, quote, "While conflicting animal results have often delayed and hampered advances in the war on cancer, they have never produced a single substantial advance in either prevention or treatment of human cancer," unquote. If even the proponents of the vivisection lobby admit that animal studies are inaccurate and produce little reliable data for human exploitation, why on earth do they continue to employ these methods? Well, Dr. Werner Hartinger, a German surgeon, surmised in 1989, quote, "There are in fact only two categories of doctors and scientists who are not opposed to vivisection, those who do not know enough about it and those who make money from it."